Welcome to Unbreaking Birth, a podcast designed to pull back the curtain,
literally and figuratively,
on what can happen in the medical system. I'm Hehe, founder of Tranquility by Hehe and creator of the Birth Lounge.
And I'm Megan, a UT Health Family Nurse Practitioner graduate specializing in women's health and previous labor and delivery nurse.
And with 16 years of combined experience, we're here to make sure you are informed as possible when having a baby in the United States.
It's not new to anyone that the United States medical system is broken, but there are ways for you to stay in control of your healthcare and be collaborative with your provider.
We will teach you how to be an active participant in your care and be your best own advocate.
You'll hear from medical professionals that prioritize patient experience, consensual care, and evidence-based medicine. You'll also hear stories from people who experience the broken parts of the system firsthand.
The more informed you are, the less anxiety you'll have.
And the more empowered you'll feel.
Let's unbreak birth together.
Hey, 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 guys. Welcome back this week. Hey, Hehe.
Hello.
Okay, guys. So last week we talked to you to introduce the Mother Friendly Birth Initiative to you guys. And this week we're going to start diving into like what exact criteria hospitals need to meet to make that mother-friendly status. So you can maybe see like, is this a place that I fully trust and want to birth at? Or are these check boxes maybe easy to meet and maybe I need to dig a little bit deeper? So we're going to get down into what makes a facility mother-friendly. So number one on the list for a facility to be mother-friendly says that they offer all birthing women unrestricted access to birth companions of her choice, including fathers, partners, children, family members, and friends. Unrestricted access to continuous emotional and physical support from a skilled doula or labor support professional, and access to professional midwifery care. And what jumps out to me right now is COVID. Like, has this been met at all whatsoever?
Not at all, which is so unfortunate because I think that in the coming years, we're going to learn that this caused a lot of unnecessary trauma in a time that was already really traumatizing and intense and scarring.
Isolating. Isolating, right? Like you're worried about your pregnancy because you've been deemed like high risk. You're worried about your baby and like that they don't have a fully maintained immune system or that they can't get vaccinations or have antibodies. And so you're already being like extra careful with who you're having over. And then you also like come to the hospital and maybe in some places, you're told you can't have support at all, not even your husband in some facilities at the beginning of COVID or some facilities if you're COVID positive.
I cannot even imagine birthing solo by myself without my partner. This one also talks about access to professional midwifery care, which is interesting because there are so many hospitals that don't have midwives on staff. And so therefore that automatically knocks them out. So if your hospital doesn't have midwifery care as an option for you, it doesn't meet the Mother-Friendly Childbirth Initiative requirements.
Yeah. So honestly, we didn't have midwifery care at my facility. So there's a few notches on here that would have knocked us out. But yeah, there's no access to having a midwife attend your birth at the hospital that I worked at. Number two says, provides accurate, descriptive, and statistical information to the public about its practices and procedures for birth care. Number two says, provides accurate, descriptive, and statistical information to the public about its practices and procedures for birth care, including measures of interventions and outcomes.
So this is interesting because I think a lot of times when we're talking about births that may not be as straightforward as low risk, you know, people who have had very standard and uneventful pregnancies, things like VBAC, twin birth, breech birth. This is where we see this one really shine because it specifically mentions the measures of interventions and the outcomes. And I think that in so many cases, we see providers and nurses sometimes give the information that is either favorable of the hospital or is not 100% transparent because there is an agenda that is trying to be followed. And that's super important for listeners to know, is you have a lot of control in that. So your control in this situation is knowing all of your options in the things that might come up in your labor, because then you're not relying on someone else to give you the information and be the filter. You are your own filter. You know all of the information. You already know all of your options. You already know what this means. You already know what you want to do in this situation. Now you just need to have this conversation with your provider to inform them on what you're choosing. You know, it's really disempowering to rely on someone else to give you your information, because then you're at their mercy of what they want or deem okay or deem important to pass along to you.
100%. Like, something that sticks out to me is VBAC birth, like you mentioned. We constantly talk about the risk of VBAC birth, I feel like, in medical facilities and with uterine rupture. But, like, are we talking about the risk of a repeat C-section? Are we talking about the risk of hemorrhage or hysterectomy if you decide to have a repeat C-section? Especially a pet peeve is when this happens to people who had a cesarean for, like, a breech birth, like, for something that was not, like, oh, your body wasn't doing it. Still not saying that you shouldn't try the second time if that was your story. But, like, if a C-section was kind of, like, brought upon you with no other reason besides, like, position of your baby or maybe something that deemed you high risk at the time, we know it's more risky statistically for you to have that second C-section than to try vaginally and see if your outcome is good. And with the risk of uterine abruption, that's also with Pitocin, P.S. Like, are we talking about VBACs that are coming in labor? Or are we talking about blowing somebody out with Pitocin? What are we talking about?
It is so interesting to me to hear you talk about the risk of that repeat C-section being higher than, obviously, a VBAC, a vaginal delivery after your C-section, because it is almost never presented that way to patients and clients. It is almost always presented as VBAC is very risky and you're unlikely to have one and you're lucky if you do, but the logical and safe thing, if we are trying to keep your baby safe, thing to do would be to have just another C-section, right? And it's just, you can feel the manipulation in that.
Yeah, for sure. We're saying these really bad things could happen to you or your baby if you don't do this, but we're not talking to you about what the risks are of this other choice. 100%. Number three says provides culturally competent care that is sensitive and responsive to the specific beliefs, values, and customs of each birthing woman's ethnicity and religion.
So this is huge. I mean, it just reminds me of how much work we have to do with, you know, people of color in our nation, because one of the things that I had no idea of until I got into this work, the great disparities that are in medicine. So we know, and it's documented really well, that Black babies and Black mamas do better when they are cared for by Black obstetricians and Black pediatricians. I think the research actually suggests that people of color always fare better when their doctor looks like them, and even better if their doctor comes from the same culture as them and can really understand those specific things that make them special to who they are. It is also unbelievable the lack of Black and Brown providers that are in the United States. So there are actually special initiatives, there are special apps, there are special programs that seek out Black and Brown providers to help partner them and pair them and get access to Black and Brown people in our nation with doctors that look like you and understand your culture. It's just when I found out how, I think the disparities, how just wide that gap was in the number of providers, but also the access to care, I was floored. I was absolutely floored.
For sure. And that makes me so sad. It makes me want to like pick up that rant as a white nurse and a white provider. But yeah, that's such a sad and disheartening statistic and position to be in, to have like, know that this is what's best for you, but to have little access to that care, for sure. Number four, I know you're going to be very passionate about from knowing your work, provides the birthing woman the freedom to walk, move about, and assume the positions of her choice during labor and birth, unless the restriction is specifically required to correct a complication, and discourages the use of lithotomy, which is flat on your back with your legs elevated, which everybody knows as your normal birthing position.
Okay, so yeah, it's just every corner you turn, the evidence, the organizations, the initiatives, they all say, don't birth on your back. Yet we see so many providers and hospitals have policies and actually implement and hold these policies, force women essentially onto their backs during labor. Actually, my friend Mandy Irby, who I also host a podcast with, that's the Pulse Check podcast geared for medical professionals who are living through these COVID times and witnessing some really questionable things. We talk about it all over there at the Pulse Check podcast. But Mandy talks about, she's a former L&D nurse, and she talks about stirrups as a restraint. And this almost tells me the same thing. It says straight up, flat on your back with legs elevated. So it doesn't name them necessarily as a restraint, but it certainly suggests that we should stay away from stirrups unless there's a medical need for them, where a lot of providers will use them in a routine manner, which is inappropriate.
Totally agree. And I think what I see as a former L&D nurse is whenever I see something about to correct a complication, really, we know being on your back can stress a baby, right? Like you are laying on your back and compressing those arteries and veins that go to your baby and from your placenta, and that can cause a baby's heart rate to drop. So what I think of as an L&D nurse is like, if we need to be sidelined because our baby is not performing well on our back, so like, that is why this is also discouraging of lithotomy, because that wouldn't be a position that we would put you in or like ask you to be in or help you get in to correct a complication. So that brings us to number five, which says, has clearly defined policies and procedures for collaborating and consulting throughout the perinatal period with other maternity services, including communicate with the original care provider when transfer from one birth site to another is necessary, and linking the mother and baby to appropriate community resources, including prenatal and post-discharge follow-up and breastfeeding support.
So this is huge. I mean, this one just points to continuity of care, which I think, again, in almost every corner that you turn down, you're bound to run into how disjointed the American healthcare system is. Very rarely do all of your providers have access to one another and talk to one another, and the systems that they're working on, you know, talks to one another and your records transfer easily. Very rarely do you see, too, all the providers in one practice very, very similarly. Usually it's really kind of whiplashy from provider to provider, which is what a lot of women get at the end of pregnancy as they are trying to meet all the providers in their practice. They are usually seeing all the providers in the practice, which again, it feels like you're being jerked from left and right because the providers vary so vastly. You know, they're so different.
Yeah. Or on another spectrum of that, like I think of an important conversation to have and an important question to ask in your first visit, like whether that's you finding out that you're pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant, is how many percent of your deliveries and your patients are you delivering? Or what does that system look like about who's on call or when are you not on call or how does that work? Because like you said, providers, even in the same practice, can differ from what they maybe allow, quote unquote, or don't allow, or on board with or skilled in. And if you have a high potential of seeing another provider in that same group, don't you want to know maybe what their birth philosophy is if you have a high likelihood of ending up with them? So that brings us to number six. So in order to be a mother-friendly hospital, your hospital also needs to not routinely employ policies and practices and procedures that are unsupported by scientific evidence.
So this is huge. I think that so many people are so unaware of the things that you can say no to when you go to have your baby in the hospital system. And all of these things are on that list. Plus, there are so many more. But IVs in particular, how many people complain about IVs after having their baby that it was A, not used, and B, super uncomfortable, that they, you know, wish they had never gotten it because it was never needed. Withholding nourishment and water, like, okay, hello, you've got to eat. You are running a labor. Not eating and drinking in labor is just absolutely crazy. Like, your uterus is a muscle and you are essentially running a marathon.
You're running through more calories than you normally do.
Exactly. That's why it's so important to be able to eat and drink when your body needs it. You know, staying hydrated is super important. Artificial rupture of membranes, that deserves its own episode, but
yes,
it is such a harmful intervention if it is misused, and people use it all the time. And then, of course, electronic fetal monitoring. I mean, the science is so clear that the more that we use it, the more problems we're going to find, the more unnecessary C-section. I mean, the science literally points out that electronic fetal monitoring has absolutely increased our C-section rate. Yet so many people just don't and won't, and maybe don't know that they can say no to electronic fetal monitoring and that the recommendation is actually intermittent monitoring, not continuous.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm sure we'll dive into this in another episode, but I think that what you just said is so important because I think, right, if we weren't continuously monitoring low-risk moms, then we wouldn't see every little dip in thing. And from experience, I do not see strips go from looking golden to looking like, oh my God, we have to do something right away. There's usually warnings. There are usually signs throughout. There are usually times where we would be like, oh, maybe we do need to keep you on the monitor if you're okay with that for the next 30 minutes and see what's going on here or whatever, right? Time and place for everything. But yeah, like there are so many reactions to EFM strips, electronic fetal monitoring, EFM, that we react to. So like knee-jerkedly maybe, where the actual evidence shows that if that wasn't the case, there wouldn't be a difference in Apgar scores or post-delivery outcomes.
That is incredible. They don't improve the outcomes, yet they do increase your risk for C-section, and they are totally 100% normalized and sold to birthing people as this thing that will keep them safe. And it just doesn't do that.
Wow. Like, if you don't let me break your water, then there is risk to your baby. Like, we need to get this baby out. Hot tip, if they needed to get your baby out, you would be having a C-section if your baby needed to come out right now. And that was like something that was a big concern. If we needed to get your baby out, we don't need to break your water at 1 centimeter. Just don't. But
say no.
Right. No is a full sentence, like you said earlier.
Say no to drugs. Say no to AROM.
Right. Say no to interventions. Also, I want to say here that I always like to say, you can say no in a way that's like, not now, right? Like, again, time and place for everything. Maybe you do reach a point in your labor that you want that, that maybe you do feel like things are stalled and want things to progress or willing to go to this intervention that can progress your labor. It could, right? But you can say no without risk of, well, this is the only opportunity I have for my doctor to break my water. Like, that's not real. That's not a thing. You can say no, not now. Thank you, though. And if they come back around in 4 hours, you could say the same thing. But maybe that night you've changed your mind and you can, and you can still have your water broken then. It is not like a all no or all yes situation. Other interventions that should be limited at your hospital, which is our number 7 point here, is they should have an induction rate of 10% or less. So they should be inducing birth on less than 10% of their births, an episiotomy rate of 20% or less with the goal of 5% or less, which is a crazy difference that we're supporting 20% or less as this gold standard. Okay. An overall cesarean rate of 10% or less in a community hospital and 15% or less in a tertiary care or high-risk hospital. And that they should have a VBAC rate, which means a vaginal birth after cesareans, of 60% or more with the goal of 75% or more. So here we are acknowledging that VBAC is safer than a second C-section or a repeat C-section.
I mean, it also reinforces the idea that all of these elective inductions should totally be avoided. I mean, 10% or less, that is not anything that we are seeing in the U.S. medical system. And that episiotomy rate with a goal of 5% just makes me think, does any hospital in America meet these requirements? I really am struggling to think about a hospital that truly meets all of these things. This is baffling. These are the questions that you need to be asking, though, right? You want to be asking your provider about their individual induction rate, about the induction rate of the hospital, about how often do they do episiotomies, in what situation would an episiotomy be needed, and how often do they do C-sections? How often do they see their inductions lead to C-sections? Now, of course, again, when you're asking them for their own stats, they can shine those any way that they want to make themselves look good, but you want to be asking deeper questions than just like, what's your induction rate? You really want to get down to the bottom of it.
Sure. Like, one of the first questions I'd also be asking is like about their VBAC rate, things like that, because again, yeah, you don't know what it's going to turn into potentially. And do you want to know if this is somebody that you want to trust? Like, maybe you want to have 3 babies and you already know that. Like, don't you want that continuity of care? Is this somebody that you trust for subsequent births, even if this is your first pregnancy? That kind of gives you a temp check of where they are and maybe where they align with you. But also, it just sticks out to me so crazily, the 10% induction rate or less, because I also want to say that they do not make a caveat about medical inductions. they say 10% or less induction rate. So we're not talking about 10% or less elective inductions. We're talking about 10% or less period, the end inductions. That's insane. Because yeah, I can't think of where that meets that requirement.
That is insane, which just goes to prove that the idea of the whole, like, well, we have a wait list for inductions, or like, oh no, we need to get you on the list. We're not going to have any inductions until next week. Like, okay, you shouldn't be having a list at all. You should be having 10%. And that means the people who literally, truly, medically need it to keep them or their baby safe.
Exactly. Or the flip side of that tells me if we have a list, then we have short staffing, which that's another episode of its own. But if you're having an induction list at a hospital that maybe claims that they do meet this standard, and then, but they're having a wait list and you're not getting in, what's your staffing look? Like, why aren't people getting in if you have such a low induction rate? And we know that safe staffing is linked to safe patient outcomes. We know that for a fact of, like, if somebody's laboring three people, how much are they going to be able to attend to you? Or, yeah, like, I mean, maybe even how much more likely is it for you to have a C-section, not just for a bad outcome, but to clear a bed space, if you think about it. And I hate to say that, but, like, yeah, why are there induction lists if you have good induction percentages, I guess, and good staffing? What's going on?
What's all business, right?
Which yeah,
for fail to recognize is, or just acknowledge. Maybe a lot of people know it. You've heard it before, but you really, yeah, haven't ever looked into it. But it is, it's a business. It's a business.
Yeah, unfortunately, I do not believe in healthcare being a business, but yes. So Hehe, now that we talked about 10% or less induction rate, a goal of 75% more of VBACs and 5% or less of episiotomies and other numbers, where can people go to find information like that if they are getting kind of blasé answers from their doctors or those offices being like, oh yeah, we do these things, or we'll keep you safe?
Yeah, so your state should collect this information. It may not always be like last year's data, but it'll give you at least a good starting point and an idea of the reputation of the facility that you're thinking about birthing at. I mean, we can't forget that they are recommending an overall C-section rate of 10% to 15% in a high-risk hospital, like 10% in a regular everyday birthing person hospital, 15% in a high-risk hospital. Like, there are high-risk hospitals out there that have C-section rates of 60, 70%, you guys.
Hey, what is the normal rate of C-section in the United States? Do you know?
Yeah, it's 33% and climbing. Like, every year we get a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And that means that a little bit less and a little bit less and a little bit less people get to have a vaginal uncomplicated delivery because instead they're having a major abdominal surgery.
Exactly. And we do want to recognize that it's easier to find the cesarean rate at your hospital, harder to find it of your provider. That's a conversation to have, but it's even harder to find these other statistics. So you might have to be a little investigative. You might have to ask some tough questions. You might really have to dig into some other evidence or some other resources to find these, like, episiotomy stats, induction stats, VBAC stats. But that's probably what you want to do about something that's such an important and pivotal moment of your life and your baby's life and your family's life.
Exactly. So we will link some resources that we have that have the states kind of broken down, but you should absolutely be prepared to do digging on your own. Like, get dirty, get down on your hands and knees and start looking for the stats. Like, don't be afraid to do some dirty digging, because these rates, they impact things, guys. If you're having your baby at a hospital that has 10% C-section rate versus a hospital that has 70% C-section rate, that is a big, big influential factor in your birth.
Absolutely. And we look up all the time, what's the best curtains on Amazon? Who has the best reviews for whatever kind of snack we want or whatever kind of home good we're buying? We should absolutely be doing this about our own health, our baby's health, and our mental health and abilities as a mother and confidence as a woman moving forward. Okay, so number 8 says that in order to be a mother-friendly birth center, that you educate staff in non-drug methods of pain relief that do not promote the use of analgesic or anesthetic drugs, not specifically required to correct a complication. So we're talking about epidurals, we're talking about Demerol, we're talking about Stadol, we're talking about any form of IV pain relief that you could be offered during labor in any form of epidural pain relief. And I guess we're even talking about, this is foreign to me because my facility didn't do this, but like gas methods of drug use. What other methods are your nursing staff or ancillary staff or doctors trained on to help get me through this birth if I do not want medical measures?
And if they say, oh yeah, they're trained on a ton, they'll be able to help you out. Okay, what? Like what specifically, yeah. Right? You shouldn't take these beat around the bush answers of like, yeah, we're going to be able to get you. Or yeah, you'll have your VBAC. No, what are you specifically going to do to help me avoid an epidural but achieve pain relief? What are you specifically trained to do and believe around VBAC? How are you specifically going to help me in this twin delivery? Like you want to be asking specific direct questions.
Right. Like, do you let me quote unquote, me get in the shower and have a break from the monitors if that's what I need to do while I'm having contractions? Or are you going to like try to make me be on continuous monitoring? Do you have maybe other support people on staff? What is your staffing ratio where I know a nurse can be in there and help me? And are they trained in things like counter pressure? Are they trained in things like spinning babies? Are they trained in things like how to help coach me through these things or massage through things or help me get in better positions? If somebody can't come up with a hard answer for you on that, what are they telling you?
Yeah, breathing techniques. Do you have access to a microwave or heat packs? Will you have access to a freezer or, ice packs? The things that you'll need to make you get comfortable. Birth balls, even like, what does the birth ball situation look like at the facility that you're birthing at? Do they just have the round balls? Do you know if they have different sizes? Do they have peanut balls? Do they have different sizes of that? We want to know what they have to offer you different pain relief.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because like maybe if you found out or knew on the front end that your birthing facility didn't have a heating pad or didn't have a peanut ball, maybe you would have chosen to get one yourself and use that. But if you don't know, how could you?
Or weren't letting you use the tub because of COVID.
Oh my God. I have not heard that one.
That is for real.
Ah, no. Why are we blaming everything on COVID? That's
everything. Life.
That's another entire conversation. Yes. Okay, so number 9 says, encourages all mothers and families, including those with sick or premature newborns or infants with congenital problems, to touch, hold, breastfeed, and care for their babies to the extent compatible with their conditions. I'm not in the NICU, so I don't know exactly what this looks like. I just know that when we have a NICU baby right at birth, especially one that's more, fortunately at my hospital, we do for lower risk, or what's considered like a level 2 NICU stay, would have them in for the first hour, could do a first feed with them, are doing skin to skin with them in that time. But if you're a higher NICU rate than that, I don't know at all what this looks like on the back end of delivery care, but I imagine that that's really hard to have continuous breastfeeding or holding or touch of babies that are in a different area of the hospital than you.
Yeah, so I can speak to it from a doula's perspective and from someone who has supported families in the NICU, and listeners, you're going to hear from parents of babies in the NICU and what their experience was like. And so you are going to hear these parents share that they were told they couldn't touch their babies or breastfeed their babies or hold their babies or do skin to skin. It happens quite often, actually. And I think a lot of parents, this is a place where they're unprepared because no one wants to think about yourself in the NICU, your baby in the NICU. And so you get in there and you don't know what your rights are as the parents of this NICU baby. And they're telling you things like, and these are things I've truly heard clients share that they were told this in, you know, by the hospital. And it's things like, well, we own your baby right now, or we are the guardians of your baby right now, or right now you don't have the authority to do that when it comes to like making decisions for this baby. And so parents really are blockaded and they don't know where to turn for resources for that. So understanding the policies around the NICU, I think, is really important. And your provider may not be 100% familiar with these things. When your baby is in the NICU, your OB's focus is you, and there will be a pediatric team that is focused on your baby. So that shouldn't necessarily be held against your OB. I mean, if I were an OB, I would fully understand what a NICU, you know, stay looked like and entailed so that I could be part of that transition with my patients. But not all OBs are going to do that. So I think what you can do is ask them, where can you learn more about the policies and procedures in the NICU that is attached to your facility? Or if there's not one that's attached to your facility, you want to be asking questions about where your baby will be sent if they require a NICU stay. That's really important as well, because you, like you pointed out, you're not always next to your baby. Sometimes they're in different buildings. Sometimes it's down the hall. Sometimes it's on another floor. Sometimes it's across these bridges that connect. Sometimes you've got to go outside. Like, it can be sometimes, and this is really hard, sometimes you and your baby are in either different parts of the city or different cities altogether until you can be released and get to your baby. And that is hard.
I can't even imagine that scenario. That is so hard. I do think that, I think this is important for everybody to talk to their partners about research, because like, yeah, you don't know, like nobody wants to think about this. Nobody wants to think, oh my God, what if I have preeclampsia? And at 32 weeks, like all of a sudden you're like at your doctor's office, your blood pressure is out of control. You get sent to like your maternal OB, like ER kind of thing, or triage, or whatever that looks like at your hospital. And your blood pressure is not coming down with medication and all of this. And all of a sudden you find yourself in a C-section with a 32-week baby. And you haven't thought about these things. You haven't had a chance to. This surprised you. You want to have like some thoughts in your mind or some background knowledge about this, I think. But I think this is particularly important for people that know that they are high-risk pregnancy. Like, we want to know, do you have a concierge service or a navigator service that provides maternity or perinatal care to NICU care? personally, my hospital now does that. And I think a lot of hospitals are moving to that, but I still think it's underutilized and is more like kind of navigating your appointments that are high risk and navigating maybe your transfer of care to a high risk doctor, or maybe navigating your C-section or something like that. But those people are there and have a NICU doctor and NICU nurses on staff to help provide you answers beforehand too, and to help navigate this process with you and answer questions with you that might come up throughout. Like, what if my baby is born at 30 weeks? What does this look like? How long of a NICU stay are we looking at? How many visitors are allowed? What are your COVID policies? What kind of access will I have to my baby right after birth? Things like that. And like, again, like he said, not questions that we want to talk about, not things we want to think about. But wouldn't it be better to think about it before you have to? Because your mind's going to be racing once that happens. And don't we want to have some like cornerstones in mind or some answers that we've sought out to kind of navigate that process with us, I guess.
It's always better to be prepared for what to expect than to be totally caught off guard and have to navigate not only the emotions, but now also the logistics.
Absolutely. Even as a medical professional, I feel like if I was caught off guard with something like that and somebody tells me, this is what we have to do for your baby, this is what's best for your baby, blah, 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 I'll just be like, okay, yes, 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 yes. And is it? Do we know what we're saying yes to? Don't we want to think about these big, important, life-altering, potentially, decisions between us and our babies? And hopefully we never need these answers. Hopefully we keep them in a back pocket, shoved in a drawer, you know, whatever. But don't we want to think about that or talk about that before we have to? Okay, so number 10 on this list, which is so interesting to me, says that facilities that are mother-friendly discourage the circumcision of the newborn.
I've never heard of a hospital or facility discouraging circumcision.
Me either. I know reasons to discourage circumcision, or that it's not routinely done in many like European countries or other first world countries in the way that it is here. But yeah, no, I've never seen that at a hospital.
Yeah, the evidence doesn't suggest that there are any benefits, but I have never ever heard of a hospital discouraging it. And this doesn't say, like, just doesn't perform them routinely. It literally uses the language discourages it. So I'm imagining staff talking to parents saying, here are the risks of this. Here are the harmful things that may happen if you do move forward with this. And, you know, it's our medical recommendation that you do not do it.
Exactly. Or at least like I picture like a brochure or like a poster that's like, don't circumcise your baby and here's why, you know. But no, I've never seen something like this at all. I don't even know. Yeah, the language is so strong in that, because like, yeah, I would say something like, respects both sides of, like, doesn't push people to have circumcisions for their newborn, or like you said, maybe doesn't routinely do them, or like, you know, just act like that's, oh yeah, we do this on every baby, but discourages circumcision. That is, yeah, that's surprising to me.
Taking a stance there, taking a real stance.
Yeah, love to see it. And I guess that brings us to our number 11, which will lead us to what we speak about with you next time. But we will be talking about the WHO UNICEF 10 Steps to Baby-Friendly Hospital Initiative to promote successful breastfeeding. And that's a requirement of a mother-friendly institution. But we will be delving into the baby-friendly initiative for breastfeeding next time we talk to you guys.
Meaning that that last step of being considered mother friendly is also that you meet the steps that are required for promoting successful breastfeeding. So I find that super interesting. I'm really excited to dive into that in the next episode. I guess we will see you later. Megan, where can people find us if they wanted to connect with us in between episodes?
So please follow us on Unbreaking Birth on Instagram. Hit us up on our podcast, and we have a link on our Instagram page where you can share your birth story or anything maybe women's health related, or just want to share a positive story with us. Please hit us up on that link, and we will see you next time.
Bye.